Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have the Robert Lowell Memorial Lecture, presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program in the College of Arts and Sciences. Our speaker is 2011 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry winner and former U.S. Poet Laureate Kay Ryan. We begin with an introduction by Boston University professor and former Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky.
Robert Lowell taught a creative writing class here at BU in room 222, the same room in which Leslie Epstein and Ha Jin and Louise Glick and I still teach the creative writing seminars. And in that class that Robert Lowell spoke, the students included Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, and George Starbuck. So when Nancy Levin and Fred Livingston kindly gave us money through the Shenson Foundation to have this series, we called it the Robert Lowell Memorial Poetry Series, in the spirit of Room 222. And the spirit of that room was, these were poets. And the academic categories of professor and student were tertiary. They were not the main thing. The main thing was pursuing the art. So in our tradition here, a recent graduate of BU's creative writing program introduces, we've had people, Seamus Heaney has given the thing, dear Grace Paley did, it was one of the last public appearances Grace had before she died. It's been quite wonderful. And the student, recent student, Kate Hollander, who will introduce Kay Ryan after reading a few poems of her own, Catherine will. Catherine has published poems in many magazines. She's currently in the doctoral program in history here. She's at that stage where you publish a lot of poems in magazines. She's been a finalist at Publishers once or twice. And sometime very soon, I'm confident, her first book of poems will be accepted. It is very unusually ambitious and unified. The book is called My German Dictionary. And you could say that the book is inspired by German culture and language as encountered from outside. It's more than that. It becomes a meditation on the phenomena of history and culture themselves. It's a very impressive piece of work. It makes me very proud to have been Catherine's teacher and makes her very suitable to be the person who's going to read for a few minutes and then introduce our wonderful guest, Kay Ryan. Catherine Hollander.
Robert. Well, I'm really glad to be here, and I'm glad you're all here too. I want to start with a poem I wrote for a friend. It's called The Party Guest. They came on the coldest night, with the old snow making stone lions in the neighborhood, muffled to the eyes like knights, wine bottles in their armpits like short lances. They came with trays of chocolate oatmeal cookies, a jewel box of sushi, green and ochre morsels tucked in rice. They brought children and fathers. They brought me a potted fern I carried at my breast, a green corsage. My friends set up in the kitchen, slicing bread, warming sake, pitting the salty black olives. The red kettle whistled for tea. We laid out a map of our city, and everyone drew where they lived. The lamps made little gold islands of quiet. The doorbell kept on ringing. And the balls of my feet began to glow, an ache settling in behind the arches. Arrivals, departures, it latened. We fell into armchairs, those who were left. A comfortable weariness set in. We let ourselves wonder about trigonometry. What is the world made of? No one else was coming. We hunkered down into the night. The last bottles flashed their necks. When the bell rang and you came into the room, the gray in your beard was like thunderbolts. As Robert mentioned, I'm a poet and also a student of history. And I often get asked how the two go together. And usually I give a sort of normal-sounding, logical answer. But these are the answers. This poem is sort of the answers that I'd like to give, the real answers, to the question, how did you get started in European history? So this poem is called Answers. One. In a green printed apron, I was standing at the window. I pressed the seams of the dumplings, slipped them into the boiling pot. Outside the kitchen, the sea arranged itself in green pews. Then a white bull emerged out of them and looked me straight in the eye. I rode side saddle on his damp back, sewing the dumplings behind me, where they floated like little boats, not making a path I could follow home. Two. My mother was a Polish Catholic. My father was a Russian Jew. They met at a university that soared like a schooner atop the sea of wheat and corn, lush yellow billows, the sky a Prussian blue. Then the snow began its never-ending overture. When I was born, Freud was my babysitter. They say I grew up with an Austrian accent, but you shouldn't believe what you hear. Three. When I was 16, I was sent away to the south of France. We drove down the coast and stopped for a meal outdoors, an avalanche of tiny golden fish, each crisp as a relic and salty as heaven, heaped on my plate like church treasure. The sun, it blinded you. I was lost and happy. At noon, the cathedral door opened and a priest led forth the newly baptized, bawling in their mother's arms, holy water leaving their heads in clouds of steam. Four. I slept under a blanket of nations. Germany was green, Russia pink and gold. At the foot of the bed, a lady was sewing. How the borders ached where her needle pierced them. After a while, I couldn't sleep. The patchwork was coming apart, letting in the cold from the wide open window. The bears and lions, no bigger than mice, snarled at one another from the pockets of her gown. Tiny eagles and airplanes circled the airspace over my head. Five. I dreamed I found a black cat half dead in the back street. Its blood made continent-shaped prints on my sleeves. It looked as if it had been in a terrible fight, but I knew it had savaged itself. Its ears were ripped and bitten out in little islands. I took it in and rubbed it with a towel. I put a dish of fresh water before it. The fire warmed its lush reddish coat. As I watched, it fell asleep. As I watched, it woke. It opened its eyes and showed me its beautiful paws, which it held out, pink as soap, like little cameos. Six. I met a man in a cafe. He was drinking sable coffee from a cup and saucer. His eyes were shy, almond-shaped, and sly. His curls lined up on his brow like snails in twilight. Where his shirt was open, his throat shone like a star. His white bed tossed like a little boat in a storm. He said, "I am every poet slaughtered, every revolutionary starved." He kissed me on the forehead, said, "Now you are marked with my own seal, and every word you write will be a letter home. Every analysis, even the most subtle, will fly to my heart like a white valentine, my sister." As some of you know, there's a long tradition among poets of writing birthday poems. So this is a poem I wrote on my birthday a few years ago. It's called Many Happy Returns. Farewell to greatness. Whatever greatness was in me, I think, was a child's greatness. And I have hung on longer than most, but I see now I have slept my last night in the igloo. Even the blue-eyed dogs have had done with my presence, and somebody has hidden my mucklucks and my woman's knife. The cooper, the cook, the sailmaker with his great thimble, they've unhooked my hammock. They shake their heads. The 12 Olympians on their risers have each lowered to me their clear amphibian eyelid, the one they wear in all their statues. Only Hephaestus is looking at me, sidelong, kind but unremitting. He knows an expulsion when he feels one. But what shall I do? Who shall I be? I think of the businessmen, confused and angry, with their four smooth pink cakes. Happy birthday indeed. I'll turn around. I'll go back. I don't think I've ever sworn in front of this many people before. That's really liberating. Do that again. This next poem is called The Wounded Soldier. I write a lot of poems that aren't in my own voice, and so here's one. Now I have a scar down the middle, like the seam where a pressed tin toy, a bird or a dog comes together. What intimacies that the doctor has seen my clockwork, has had his hands inside my softness. Who's after me this time? Napoleon? Bismarck? Patrocles, the lovely doomed. I could lie here in the fragrance of naphtha. During my worst sickness, I was so lost and hungry that I went out of myself into the North Hills and over the ice, and only a family of bears had pity on me. They had taken off their skins and hung them up in the hallway, and without them, they looked just like men. Their children looked just like our children. For me, they boiled meat, though they ate it raw themselves. What courtesy. When they were sending me home, they said, "Don't tell the other men about us. We have children, and they deserve to grow up." They lifted the dark metal from over my heart. It's better to breathe deeply than to be praised. Okay, this will be the last one that I'll read. I began writing this poem for a friend who is a social worker who was going to Haiti after the earthquake, and it was clear that he was going to really be dealing with some tough stuff. And then I was revising it, and I sort of wanted to make it for my brother, and then I was revising it, and a new baby was born to a friend of mine, and I sort of wanted to make it for her. So really it's for all of them, and for all of us, and all of you. Protection poem. May your heart go sheathed in a mail of raindrops. May your skin reject the dirty handprint of disappointment, and may a pale blue globe of comprehension spin gently in your mind, showing its continents. May nothing seem repulsive, yet may you walk away, and quickly, from spoils and explosives. Let no one touch you cruelly. Avoid all the wrestling holds of manipulation and bad love. Walk through all the dangers, and I mean the real ones, wounds and hunger, the smolder glow of fires, but cleanly, clearly, as though across your collarbone a row of beach shells on a string clicked and shone with the light of your purity. Thanks. Now it's my pleasure to introduce to you the former poet laureate and recent winner of the Pulitzer Prize, Kay Ryan. A few years ago, in a workshop I belonged to, one poet described another's collection of poems as being like a solar system with only small planets. It's possible that the comment was not meant entirely as a compliment, but I loved the idea and the image. In a solar system with only small planets, there would be no dominance, no looming grandeur. All the details would be sharp and manageable, and you could tour each planet slowly and lovingly, getting to know all the ecosystems. In 2008, Megan O'Rourke wrote that our new poet laureate, Kay Ryan, is a miniaturist, and she did mean it as a compliment. But I don't really think Ryan's poems are miniatures. I think they are like small planets. Because each one is disarmingly, misleadingly simple. Because they are intimate and tactile. Because they are shocking and appealing and bright. Because, after all, who is to say that a solar system with only small planets isn't actually a solar system with only big planets? Planets that expand and complicate the more you explore them. Planets where a turtle is a four-oared helmet, and thoughtlets at play in the mind are untarnished as herring. Where unchosen alligators grin from the blankety waters. Where a hailstorm is a maelstrom of ferocious little fists and punches. And where snails slide over diamonds, never sharpening their feet. Kay Ryan has won 4 Pushcart Prizes, the Ruth Lilly Prize, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and was Poet Laureate of the United States from 2008 to 2010. As you all know, she was just awarded the Pulitzer Prize for her book, The Best of It. And now she's going to read to us. Please welcome her.
Thank you, Catherine, for your poetry and for the wonderful introduction. I like the idea that planets could be just arguably large. You know, if they're all the same, who's not to say they're big, huh? You know? Yeah. That was smart. It's great to be here. I'm delighted, and I'm delighted to be part of the Robert Lowell Memorial reading series in the spirit of Room 222? All right. Okay. You know, after getting that big prize, I look back at my work and I'm trying to lend it some metal or something, you know, try to beef it up a little bit. I thought I'd start with a little poem that gives me a little gravity because it was inspired by something that I read in the Frick Museum in New York. And I was looking at one of the great paintings and there's a little sign and it said, "Pentimenti of an earlier position of the arm may be seen." Pentimenti being something that was decided against and covered up, something that the artist repented. I got to thinking about pentimenti. This ends with, this has a rhyme in it. I thought, you know, that I'd better start getting a little bit more articulate about what I'm doing with rhyme now, you know. I have to, you know, to explain these things, point out the varieties and such. Pentimenti. It's not simply that the top image wears off or goes translucent. Things underneath come back up, having enjoyed the advantages of rest. That's the hardest part to bear, how the decided against fattens one layer down, free of the tests applied to final choices. In this painting, for instance, see how a third arm, long ago repented by the artist, is revealed, working a flap into the surface through which who knows what exiled cat or extra child might steal. Now you're thinking, what's the rhyme? It's something, I was looking at this the other night, trying to, you know, become more important. It's hard at the last minute, you know. Oh, as a matter of fact, I have a poem about that. I think I'll read it. It's called "We're Building the Boat as We Sail It." You know that expression? Oh, well, I guess I should finish up with this one. Okay, so here's the rhyme. So the poem ends, "In this painting, for instance, see how a third arm, long ago repented by the artist, is revealed, working a flap into the surface through which who knows what exiled cat or extra child might steal." Okay, exiled? No, extra child. See, this is called wedge rhyme. You take exiled and you wedge into it tra chai, and you have extra child. Exiled. See? I had never thought about that before. You know? I mean, you know, you do things, but you don't think about it. You think, oh, that sounds neat. But you don't think that it might be a technique, and if you said it was one, then it would be one. You know? Oh, using that wedge rhyme, huh? Wedge rhyme. So, I was going to say we're building the, this is what I'm having to do. We're building the ship as we sail it. I heard this on public radio. I think this woman was talking about starting a company. It was a startup, and they hadn't really finished figuring out how the company would run, and they were having to run it. So, the first fear of being drowning, the ship's first shape was a raft, which was hard to unflatten after that didn't happen. It's awkward to have to do one's planning in extremis in the early years. So hard to hide later, sleekening the hull, making things more gracious. Here's a rhyme poem. This is a poem that demonstrates its argument. It's called "Bait Goat," which I like to say. I mean, it's just a nice thing to say, "bait goat." It's like, you know, like a bait fish. But a goat. So, there is a distance where magnets pull, we feel, having held them back. Likewise, there is a distance where words attract. Set one out like a bait goat and wait, and seven others will approach. But watch out. Roving packs can pull your word away. you find your stake yanked and some rough bunch to thank. For me, getting a single line down of a poem, well, obviously it has a lot of words in it, and each one of those words wants to bring its family into this country, you know? And I'm all for that. I'm on the right side of that. But, of course, we have to have some rules. But there is this matter of words. The glory of rhyme is that it has nothing to do with logic. It has nothing to do with sense. It introduces elements that we couldn't think of with our right mind. I mean, I guess we have to think them with our left mind. Or maybe I have that backwards. But one way or the other. So I mean, this kind of poem that you couldn't write if it didn't help you write it. Did any of you read that article about the man who is, he's studying the nature of time and its elasticity? Very neat article. He became fascinated with this business of the irregularity of time, I mean, that it expands and contracts, when he fell through an unfinished roof as a child. There was tar paper over it, and he walked out onto the tar paper and fell. And the time between, you know, beginning to fall and hitting the bottom was extremely long, and he had time enough to think, as an 8-year-old, this must be what Alice felt like going down the rabbit hole, falling down the rabbit hole. I mean, he thought that in bang, you know, I mean, you know, it would just be have been terrifically fast. And he was ever more fascinated with this business about the stretchability and pliability, rubberiness, and strange irregularity and inconsistencies of time. So this is called Edges of Time. And I will confess to you, because I know that you won't tell anyone else, that it has sort of an ignoble beginning. I'm sort of a slow getter out of the house, and my partner was a very efficient getter out of the house. And so she would be standing at the door jangling her keys, and I would need to put the dishes away, you know, and just do any number of things which suddenly became urgent. I mean, the truth is they took on a real urgency because of this preciousness, you know, this tiny amount of time. And so here's a poem that actually has such a pedestrian beginning, and I hope it sounds much grander than that. It is at the edges that time thins. Time, which had been dense and viscous as amber, suspending intentions like bees, unseizes them. A humming begins, apparently coming from stacks of put-off things, or just in back. A racket of claims now, as time flattens. A glittering fan of things competing to happen. Brilliant and urgent as fish when seas retreat. I think I masked it fairly well, don't you? Yeah. Okay, in this poem, I want you to think that you're on one side of a train track, trains going by, and something is on the other side. Train track figure. Imagine a train track figure made of sliver over sliver of between car vision, each slice too brief to add detail or deepen. That could be a hat. If it's a person, if it's a person, if it's a person. Just the same scant information, time to supplant the same scant information. I was raised to important years I spent on the Mojave Desert, and so the wanting of water. Well, frequent in California anyhow, the desire for water, the desire for rain, frequent in the West, kind of animates this poem called Virga, which is a term I discovered by reading the weather page of the newspaper, where the weather lady in the little box up in the corner with her face in it. She tells you certain things, you know, a little fun weather fact. And on this day, she defined Virga, which I'm sure a few of you in here know. It is rain that never reaches the ground. You know, it's up in the sky. Virga. There are bands in the sky where what happens matches prayers. Clouds blacken, and inky rain hatches the air like angled writing. The very transcription of a pure command, steady from a steady hand. Drought put to rout, visible a mile above for miles about. This is a little poem which is called Dogleg. I love that word because it so perfectly embodies what it is. You know, it can be a noun or a verb. And I would like to just warn you that this poem Doglegs. Another poem that's demonstrating itself. Birds' legs do, of course, all dog leg, giving them that bounce. But these are not normal odds around the house. Only two of the dog's legs, dog leg, and two of the cat's. 50-50. That's as bad as it gets, usually, despite the fear you feel when life has angled brutally. See, it doesn't do any good to warn somebody that there's going to be a dog leg. You know, if it says dog leg ahead, what doesn't help a bit, you know? You still get your head jerked, you know? Oh, now, I had the pleasure of having dinner with a number of wonderful people, including Louise Glick, and she and I got into an animated conversation about liking murder mysteries. And she confessed as to have used some lines from Henning Mankell, the great Swedish mystery writer, in her Averno, and I said that I had also used an epigraph by Mankell in this very book, and I will now read that. I've often thought that maybe my real project is not to write poems, but to preserve epigraphs, you know? But my books are really just the carriers of great snippets of previous wonderful language. That would be fine. This is called The Pharaohs, and Henning Mankell writes in The White Lioness, "The pharaohs killed those who had built the secret chambers of the pyramids to ensure that any knowledge of their existence would be lost." The moral is simple. Don't help other people with their secrets. But within the self, what defense is there against the pharaohs who demand chambers we must build on pain of death, after which we're killed? A person is as a kingdom and can afford some losses toward the construction of underground systems, say the pharaohs, shutting their cunning doors that never were and won't be evermore. I don't expect you to understand that one. Now here's another, another mystery writer, Cyril Hare, the British mystery writer. He has to be British, doesn't he? With a name like Cyril Hare. This is called When Fishing Fails, and here's the epigraph. Your husband is very lucky, observed Smithers, to have ornithology to fall back upon when fishing fails. To me, that's like the ideal life, you know? This starts out sounding kind of Yeatsian, but it declines quickly. When fishing fails. When fishing fails, when no bait avails, and nothing speaks in liquid hints of where the fishes went for weeks, and dimpled ponds and silver creeks go flat and tarnish. It's nice if you can finish up your sandwich, pack your thermos, and ford this small hiatus toward a second mild and absorbing purpose. You know how Satie wrote Furniture Music? He wanted it to be just sort of as given as chairs and couches and so on. Well, sometimes, like in that poem, I just like to write something that would be nice to sit in, you know, something comfortable. Oh, here's a... You know, when you're putting your reading together, it makes some kind of sense, then later it doesn't, you know, when you're, you just wonder why you ever thought that. Okay, now, this is called Cloud. I'll give you a little help. In the beginning, you're looking at the effects, you're looking down on woods that have clouds darkening them. Still, you're up high looking down, and then later you're not. And all this happens very quickly. Cloud. A blue, and this is a cheerful poem. I want you to be ready for the fact that this has a lovely, lovely, cheering ending. A blue stain creeps across the deep pile of the evergreens. From inside the forest, it seems like an interior matter, something wholly to do with trees. A color passed from one to another, a requirement to which they submit unflinchingly, like soldiers or brave people getting older. Then the sun comes back, and it's totally over. Oh, this poem comes from a time when I felt that I guess I was trying to make a space for certain aesthetic preferences that were in disrepute. This poem is really trying, I think came from kind of some attitudes of the 70s where everything, you know, it was all crunchy granola and burlap and unrefined everything. And this is a poem loving elaboration. You know, it's saying that the ornamental is not suspect. I mean, it's trying to make some claims for curlicues and ornaments and beauty and excess. So it's a political poem, and a protest poem. So this is, and I'm going to read another protest poem too. Remind me. It's called Impersonal, okay? I'll read it right after I read this, okay? Flamingo watching. Oh, I want to tell you, probably a few in this audience do not know what a furbelow is. It's like a flounce or a ruffle. Wherever the flamingo goes, she brings a city's worth of furbelows. She seems unnatural by nature, too vivid and peculiar a structure to be pretty, and flexible to the point of oddity. Perched on those legs, anything she does seems like an act. Descending on her egg or draping her head along her back, she's too exact and sinuous to convince an audience she's serious. The natural elect, they think, would be less pink, less able to relax their necks, less flamboyant in general. They privately expect that it's some poorly jointed, bland, gray animal with mitts for hands whom God protects. Oh, now, impersonal. I've strayed from my playlist here now. Well, as you know, the Kabbalists don't read the Bible narratively. They divine messages from it by the use of abstract systems. And this poem, I think, starts in a really funny way because it says, the working Kabbalist. I mean, that's the first line, the working Kabbalist. And I kind of like that. Sort of sounds like the working cowboy, you know, so I sort of see these Marlboro Kabbalists, you know. I just like that. Because they don't have a nice, tough image the way smokers do, you know. So this is a poem arguing for the impersonal. The working Kabbalist, and then there's some really funny stuff that happens right after that, and I'll stop there again. The working Kabbalist resists the lure of the personal. She suspends interest in the biblical list of interdicted shellfish, say, in order to read the text another way. Now, the funny thing to me is what is personal about the interdicted list of shellfish, you know? That to me, that's, I just never get tired of that. The working Kabbalist resists the lure of the personal. She suspends interest in the biblical list of interdicted shellfish, say, in order to read the text another way. It might seem to some superficial to convert letters to numerals, or in general refuse plot in favor of dots or half circles. It might easily seem comical how she ignores an obviously erotic tale except for every third word, rising for her like Braille, for something vivid as only the impersonal can be, a crescent bright as the moon, a glimpse of a symmetry, a message so vast in its passage that she must be utterly open to an alien idea of person. I thought it was a good life tactic to make myself smaller, to be a smaller target, you know, to be, it seemed like you'd get in less trouble, you know, to just live quietly and in miniature. And this poem talks about how that works out. This life, it's a pickle, this life. Even shut down to a trickle, I'm not even ashamed of that. Pickle, trickle. You know, I like that. I like that. It's a pickle, this life. Even shut down to a trickle, it carries every kind of particle that causes strife on a grander scale. To be miniature is to be swallowed by a miniature whale. Zeno knew the law that we know. No matter how carefully diminished, a race can only be half finished with success. Then comes the endless halving of the rest, the ribbon-stalled approach, the helpless red-faced urgings of the coach. You know, Catherine's poems were somehow evoking in my mind sort of Chagall-y feelings. I was getting some kind of Chagall thing going there. And I've got a poem in response, in a way. This is called The Tables Freed, and it has a little epigraph by Chagall. The presence of real objects is a nightmare for me. I have always overturned objects. A chair or table turned upside down gives me peace and satisfaction. The Tables Freed. A companionable flood can make things wobble. The sober table at last enjoys the bubbles locked in her grain, straining together good as Egyptians to shift the predictable plane. Dense plates and books slide off and dive or bloat, but she floats, a legged boat, nosing the helpless stationaries, the bolted basin, the metal reliquaries, in short, the nouns. All over town, tables are bumping out of doors, negotiating streets, and beginning to meet at water corners like packs of mustangs, blue, red, yellow, stenciled, enlivened by swells as wild horses are stretched liquid and elegant by hills. I love fake stuff. So I have some poems about fake This little one I think is amusing. It's called The Mock Ruin, and it has an epigraph from one of my great sources of inspiration, which has been Ripley's Believe It or Not. Listen to this interesting fact. The mock ruin, built as the backdrop of the stage of the ancient Roman theater in Sabratha, Libya, Africa, is the most perfectly preserved part of the entire structure. So the mock ruin lasted better. It's less ruined than the real stuff. I just liked that. I think the genuine is such a tyranny, you know, all this business about the genuine. Fakes and mock-ups, stage backdrops, quickly nicked, weathered, and stuck together for illusion's sake, getting some parts backwards. Give more, maybe. Sway slightly. Take later buffets better generally than their brittle sources, whose stones were set down in regular courses and mortared. Maybe there is something to falseness that doesn't get reported. Here's a poem that seems like it's about spring, but it's really about the mystery of how anything changes, how we ever change our minds, how one thing becomes another, the imponderable gulf between one thing and another thing, one condition and another thing, another condition. Spring. Winter, like a set opinion, is routed. What gets it out? The imposition of some external season or some internal doubt? I see the yellow maculations spread across bleak hills of what I said I'd always think. A stippling of white upon the gray, a pink the shade of what I said I'd never say. Oh, here's a little tiny poem, even by my standards, of a new spring offering, never published yet. Do you have cicadas here? Oh, good. Spring. It would be good to shrug out of winter as cicadas do. Look, a crisp, freestanding you, and you walking off soft as new. I don't know much about cicadas. I don't really know if they're soft when they get out of that shell, but I know they leave those spooky husks, don't they? Yeah. This is a blossom poem. It kind of, you know, it's really thinking about something else. It's comparing people and trees and how different we are. So different. A tree is lightly connected to its blossoms. For a tree, it is a pleasant sensation to be stripped of what's white and winsome. If a big wind comes, any nascent interest in fruit scatters. This is so different from humans, for whom what is unset matters so oddly, as though only what is lost held possibility. Here's a poem I never read. And there might be a good reason, and you know, maybe as I air it again here, I will remember why I don't read it. This is called Miner's Canaries. It isn't arbitrary. It isn't curious. Miner's canaries serve ordinary purposes with just a fillip of extra irony. Something is always testing the edges of the breathable. Not so sweet, not so yellow, but something is always living at the wrong edge of the arable. Something is always excused first from the water table, chalking the boundary of the possible from the far side, even in the individual. Well, I imagine this room is made up almost exclusively of writers. And then you all know that getting started is the hardest part. So hard to start. It's hard to start if you're exercising. It's hard to start almost anything. It's just hard to start. I mean, I run, and I've been running for 40 years, and it's still hard to start. And then I'm out running, and I'm saying, well, gee, it's so great to be out here. It's just always so hard. But in any case, if you can start, things can happen. And this is an invocation, really, and it's called deer. And it's making some deer here. But you could make anything the same way once you've got the formula. To lure a single swivel ear, one tentative twig of a leg, or a nervous tail here, is to mark this place as the emperor's park, rife with deer. For if one leaf against the littered floor be cleft with the true arc, all this lost ground and more becomes a park. Everywhere the nearest deer signals the nearest dark. A buck looks up. The touch of his rack against wet bark whispers a syllable singular to deer. The next one hears and shifts. The next head stops and lifts deeper and deeper into the park. And now I'm on an animal run here, so I'll read a little. No, this is big. This is a big poem. This one takes some time. This is called Turtle, and it comes from a period when I was just toweringly frustrated. It was a very long period of great frustration. And the kind of compression that's in this poem, all the sounds and all the metaphors tumbling over each other, is so compacted. It just seems to me to express so much frustration, just in its method. It also has my very best rhyme ever. And I'll give you a hint. One word then rhymes exactly with three other words that follow shortly thereafter. Okay. You know, what was that? Remember the children's story? Four in one blow? However many is it? Seven in one blow? Yeah, so I should get three in one word. You know, I get a belt. You know, the rhymer's belt. Three in one word. Turtle. Who would be a turtle who could help it? A barely mobile hard roll. A four-oared helmet. She can ill afford the chances she must take in rowing toward the grasses that she eats. Her track is graceless, like dragging a packing case places, and almost any slope defeats her modest hopes. Even being practical, she's often stuck up to the axle on her way to something edible. With everything optimal, she skirts the ditch which would convert her shell into a serving dish. She lives below luck level, never imagining some lottery will change her load of pottery to wings. Her only levity is patience, the sport of truly chastened things. I have no idea if I've been reading for just a really long time or not. I think we're kind of closing in on the end of this reading, in which case I would like to read a cheering poem. This is called Odd Blocks, also a nice thing to say. Every Swiss village calendar instructs as to how stone gathers the landscape around it, how glacier-scattered thousand-ton monuments to randomness become fixed points in finding home. Order is always starting over. And why not also in the self? The odd blocks all lost and left become first facts, toward which later a little town looks back. Now I have to reread it. Okay. And it probably went by too fast the first time. I mean, the Swiss village calendar, that would be, you know, like you get a calendar of pretty pictures of Swiss villages. That's all I mean there. But I don't know how you can get all that with it just racing by you on one reading or hearing. I wouldn't. Every Swiss village calendar instructs as to how stone gathers the landscape around it, how glacier-scattered thousand-ton monuments to randomness become fixed points in finding home. Order is always starting over. And why not also in the self? The odd blocks, all lost and left, become first facts, toward which later a little town looks back. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You have just heard the Robert Lowell Memorial Lecture presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program in the College of Arts and Sciences. Our speaker was 2011 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry winner and former U.S. Poet Laureate Kay Ryan. We began with an introduction by Boston University professor and former Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Wydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.